is all. Take it from the top. Tell us the story. I got pizza coming and there's more cigarettes. We got the time.
It won't take any time. I didn't see anything except the body in there. I hope there's no anchovies.
He said this, looking at Wish while pulling himself up in the chair. He had established a pattern in which he would look at Bosch when he was telling the truth, at Wish when he was shading it or outright lying. Scammers always play to the women, Bosch thought.
Sharky, Bosch said, if you want, we can take you up to Silmar and have him hold you overnight. We can start again in the morning, maybe when your memory's a little...
I'm worried about my bike back there. Might get stole.
Forget the bike, Bosch said, leaning into the boy's personal space.
We aren't spoiling you, Sharky. You haven't told us anything yet. Start the story, then we'll worry about the bike.
Okay, okay. I'll tell you everything.
The boy reached for his cigarettes on the table, and Bosch pulled back and got out one of his own. The leaning in and out of his face was a technique Bosch had learned while spending what seemed like 10,000 hours in these little rooms. Lean in. Invade that foot and a half that is all theirs, their own space. Lean back when you get what you want. It's subliminal. Most of what goes on in a police interrogation has nothing to do with what is said. It is interpretation, nuance, and sometimes what isn't said. He lit Sharky's cigarette first. Wish leaned back in her chair as they exhaled the blue smoke.
You want to smoke, Agent Wish?
Bosch said. She shook her head no. Bosch looked at Sharky, and a knowing look passed between them. It said, you and me, sport. The boy smiled. Bosch nodded for him to start his story, and he did. And it was a story.
I go up there to crash sometimes, Sharky said. You know, when I don't find anybody to help me out with some motel money or nothing. Sometimes the room at my cruise motel is too crowded. I gotta get out. So I go up there, sleep in the pipe. It stays warm most of the night. Not bad. So anyway, it was one of those nights. So I went up there. What time was this?
Wish asked. Bosch gave her a look that said, cool it. Ask the questions after the story is out. The kid had been going pretty good.
Yeah, must have been pretty late, Sharky answered. 3, maybe 4 o'clock. I don't have a watch. And so I went up there, and I went in the pipe, and I saw the guy that was dead, just laying there. I climbed out and split. I wasn't going to stay in there with a dead guy. When I got down the hill, I called you guys, 911.
He looked back from Wish to Bosch.
That's it, he said. Can I get a ride back to my bike?
No one answered, so Sharky lit another cigarette and pulled himself up in the chair.
That's a nice story, Edward, but we need the whole thing, Bosch said. We also need it right.
What do you mean?
I mean it sounds like it was made up by a moron, is what I mean.
How'd you see the body in there?
I had a flashlight,
he explained to Wish. No, you didn't. You had matches. We found one. Bosch leaned forward until his face was only a foot from the boy's.
Sharky, how do you think we knew it was you that called? You think the operator just recognized your voice? Oh, that's old Sharky. He's a good kid, calling us about the body. Think, Sharky. You signed your name, or at least half of it on the pipe up there. We got your prints off a half a can of paint, and we know you only crawled halfway in the pipe. That's when you got scared and got out. You left tracks.
Sharky stared forward, his eyes slightly lifted toward the mirrored window on the door.
You knew the body was there before you went in. You saw somebody drag it into the pipe, Sharky. Look at me now and tell the real story.
Look, I didn't see nobody's face. It was too dark, man,
the boy said to Bosch. Eleanor let out a breath. Bosch felt like telling her that if she thought the boy was a waste of time, she could leave.
I was hiding, Sharky said, because, see, at first I thought they were after me or something. I had nothing to do with this. Why are you dragging me down, man?
We got a dead man, Edward. We've got to find out why. We don't care about faces. That's fine. Tell us what you did see, and then you're no longer in it.
That'll be it?
That'll be it.
Bosch leaned back then and lit his second cigarette.
Oh, yeah. I was up there, and I wasn't too tired yet, so I was doing my painting, and I heard a car coming. Like, holy shit. And what was weird was that I heard it before I saw it, because the guy has no lights on. So, man, I hauled ass and hid in the bushes on the hill right by there. You know, right by the pipe, right by where I hid my bike, you know, while I'm sleeping.
The boy was becoming more animated, using his hands and nodding his head, and looking mostly at Bosch now.
Shit, I thought those guys were coming for me, like somebody had called the cops on account of me being up there spraying a script or something. So, like, I hid. In fact, when they got there, a guy gets out and says to the other guy he smells paint, but it turns out they didn't even see me. They just stopped by the pipe because of the body. And only it wasn't a car either, it was a Jeep.
You get a license plate number?
Wish said. Let him tell it, Bosch said without looking at her.
No, I didn't get a fucking plate. Shit, their lights were off and it was too dark. So anyway, there was three of them if you count the dead guy. One guy gets out. He was the driver, and he pulls the dead guy right out of the back from underneath a blanket or something. Open little back door those Jeeps got and drug the guy onto the ground. Man, it was total horror, man. I could tell it was real. You know, a real dead body, just kind of by the way it fell on the ground. Like a dead guy. It made a noise like a body. Not like on TV, but what you'd expect, like, oh no, that's a body he drug out of there or something. Then he drug it into the pipe. The other guy wouldn't help him. He stayed in the Jeep, so the first dude, he did it by himself.
Sharky took a deep drag on his cigarette and then killed it in the tin ashtray, which was already full of ash and old butts. He exhaled through his nose and looked at Bosch, who just nodded for him to continue. The boy pulled himself up in the seat.
I stayed there, and the guy came out of the pipe after a minute. No longer than that. He looked around when he came out but didn't see me. He went over to a bush near where I was hiding and tore off a branch. Then he went back inside the pipe for a while, and I could hear him in there sweeping or something with the branch. Then he came out and they left. Oh, and he started to back up, and the reverse light went on, you know. He took it out of gear, like, real quick. Then I heard him say something about they couldn't go backward because of the light. They might get seen. So then they went forward, you know, without lights. They drove down the road and across the dam and around the other side of the lake. And when they went by that little house on the dam, they bashed the light bulb. I saw it go out. I stayed hidden till I couldn't hear the engine anymore. And then I come out.
Sharky stopped the story for a beat, and Wish said,
I'm sorry, can we open the door, get some of this smoke out of here?
Bosch reached over and pulled the door open without getting up or trying to hide his annoyance. Go on, Sharky, was all he said.
So, when they were gone, I went over to the pipe and yelled into the guy. You know, hey in there, and are you all right, stuff like that. But nobody answered, so I leaned my bike down on the ground so the light would go in there, and I crawled in a little bit. I also lighted a match, like you say, and I could see him in there, and he looked dead and all. I was going to check, but it was too creepy. I got out, I went down the hill, and I called the cops. That's all I did, and that's the whole thing.
Bosch figured the boy was going to rob the body but got scared halfway in. That was okay, though. The boy could keep that as his secret. Then he thought of the branch taken from the bush and used by the man Sharky had seen to obliterate the tracks and drag marks in the pipe. He wondered why the uniform cops hadn't come across either the discarded branch or the broken bush during the crime scene search. But he didn't dwell on it long, because he knew the answer. Sloppiness. Laziness. It wasn't the first time things had been missed, and wouldn't be the last. We're going to go check on that pizza, Bosch said, and he stood up. We'll only be a couple of minutes. Outside the interview room, Bosch checked his anger and said, My fault. We should have talked more about how we wanted to do it before we heard his story. I'd like to hear what they have to say first, then ask questions. It was my fault.
No problem, Wish said curtly. He doesn't seem that valuable anyway.
Maybe, he thought a moment. I was thinking of going back in and talking a little more to him, maybe bring an identikit in, and if he doesn't get any better at remembering things, we could hypnotize him. Bosch had no way of knowing what her reaction to the last suggestion would be. He offered it in an offhand manner, half hoping it would slip by unnoticed. California courts had ruled that hypnotizing a witness taints that witness's later court testimony. If they hypnotized Sharky, he could never be a witness in any court case that could arise from the Meadows investigation. Wish frowned. I know, Bosch said. We'd lose him in court. But we might never get to court with what he's given us now. You just said yourself he's not that valuable.
I just don't know whether we should close the door on his usefulness now, so early in the investigation.
Bosch walked over to the interview room door and looked through the one-way glass at the boy. He was smoking another cigarette. He put it down on the ashtray and stood up. He looked at the door window, but Bosch knew he couldn't see out. The boy quickly and quietly switched his chair with the one Wish had been using. Bosch smiled and said, "He's a smart kid. There might be more that we won't get unless we put him under. I think it's worth the chance."
"I didn't know you were one of LAPD's hypnotists. I must have missed that in your file."
"I'm sure there's a lot you missed," Bosch replied. After a few moments, he said, "I guess I'm one of the last around. After the Supreme Court shot it down, the department quit training people. There was only one class of us. I was one of the youngest. Most of the others have retired."
"Anyway," she said, "I don't think we should do it yet. Let's talk to him some more. Maybe wait a couple days before we waste him as a witness."
"Fine, but in a couple days, who knows where a kid like Sharky will be?"
"Oh, you're resourceful. You found him this time. You can do it again."
"You want to take a shot in there?"
"No, you're doing okay. As long as I can jump in now, whenever I think of something."
She smiled, and he smiled, and they went back into the interview room, which smelled of smoke and sweat. Bosch left the door open again to air it out. Wish didn't have to ask.
"No food?"
Sharky said. "Still on the way," Bosch said. Bosch and Wish took Sharky through his story two more times, picking up small details along the way. They did it as a team, partners, exchanging knowing looks, surreptitious nods, even smiles. A few times Bosch noticed Wish slipping in her chair and thought he saw a smile play on Sharky's boyish face. When the pizza came, he protested the anchovies but still ate three-quarters of the pie and downed two of the Cokes. Bosch and Wish passed. Sharky told them the Jeep that Meadows' body came in was dirty white or beige. He said there was a seal on the side door, but he could not describe it. Perhaps this was so it would look like a DWP vehicle, Bosch thought. Maybe it was a DWP vehicle. Now he definitely wanted to hypnotize the boy, but he decided not to bring it up again. He'd wait for Wish to come around, to see that it had to be done. Sharky said the one who stayed behind in the Jeep as the body was dragged into the pipe didn't say a word the whole time the boy watched. This person was smaller than the driver. Sharky described seeing only a slightly built form, a whisper of a silhouette against what little light there was from the moon above the reservoir perimeter's thick stand of pine.
"What did this other guy do?" Wish asked. "Just watched, I guess, like a lookout. He didn't even do the driving. I guess he was in charge of something."
The boy got a better look at the driver, but not enough to describe a face or to make a drawing with the facial templates and the identikit that Bosch had brought into the interview room. The driver had dark hair and was white. Sharky couldn't, or wouldn't, be any more exact in his description. He had worn matching dark shirt and pants, maybe overalls. Sharky also said that he wore some kind of equipment belt or carpenter's apron. Its dark tool pockets hung empty at the hips and flapped like an apron at his waist. This was curious to Bosch, and he asked Sharky several questions, coming at it from different angles but getting no better description. After an hour, they were finished. They left Sharky in the smoky room while they conferred outside again. Wish said,
"All we have to do now is find a Jeep with a blanket in the back, do a microanalysis and match hairs. Only must be a couple million white or beige Jeeps in the state. You want me to put out a bolo, or you want to handle it?"
"Look, 2 hours ago we had nothing. Now we've got a lot. If you want, let me hypnotize a kid. Who knows, we might get a license plate, a better description of the driver. Maybe he'll remember a name spoken, or be able to describe the seal on the door." Bosch held his hands out, palms up. His offer was out, but she had already turned it down, and she did again.
"Not yet, Bosch. Let me talk to Rourke. Maybe tomorrow. I don't want to rush into that and possibly have it come back on us as a mistake, okay?"
He nodded and dropped his hands.
"So what now?" she said.
"Well, the kid's eaten. Why don't we get him squared away and then you and I get something to eat? There's a place..."
"I can't," she said.
"On Overland, I know."
"I already have plans for tonight. I'm sorry. Maybe we can make it another night?"
"Sure." He walked over to the interview room door and looked through the glass. anything to avoid showing his face to her. He felt foolish for trying to move so quickly with her. He said, "If you have to get going, go ahead. I'll get him in his shelter or something for the night. We don't both have to waste our time with it."
"You sure?"
"Yeah, I'll take care of him. I'll get a patrol unit to take us. We'll get his bike on the way. I'll have him drop me by my car."
"That's nice. I mean about you getting his bike and taking care of him."
"Well, we made a deal with him, remember?"
"I remember. But you care about him. I watched how you handled him. You see some of yourself there?"
He turned away from the glass to look at her. "No, not especially," he said. "He's just another wit that has to be interviewed. You think he's a little bastard now, wait another year. Wait till he's 19 or 20, if he makes it. He'll be a monster then, preying on people. This isn't the last time he'll be sitting in that room. He'll be in and out of there his whole life till he kills somebody or they kill him. It's Darwin's rule, survival of the fittest, and he's fit to survive. So no, I don't care about him. I'm putting him in a shelter because I want to know where he is in case we need him again, that's all."
"Nice speech, but I don't think so. I know a little bit about you, Bosch. You care, all right. The way you got him dinner and asked him..."
"Look, I don't care how many times you read my file. You think that means you know about me? I told you, that's bullshit." He had come up close to her until his face was only a foot from hers, but she looked away from him, down at her notebook, as if what she had written there might have something to do with what he was saying. "Look," he said, "we can work this together, maybe even find out who killed Meadows if we get a few more breaks like the one with the kid today. But we won't really be partners, and we won't really know each other. So maybe we shouldn't act like we do. Don't tell me about your little brother with a crew cut and how he looks the way I did, because you don't know how I was. A bunch of papers and pictures in a file don't say anything about me." She closed the notebook and put it in her purse. Then she finally looked up at him. There was a knocking from inside the interview room. Sharky was looking at himself in the mirrored window of the door, but they both ignored him, and Wish just drilled Bosch with her eyes.
"You always get this way when a woman turns you down for dinner?"
she asked calmly. "It's got nothing to do with it, and you know it."
"Sure, I know it."
She started to walk away, then said,
"Let's say 9 a.m., we meet at the bureau again?"
He didn't answer, and then she did walk away toward the squad room door. Sharky pounded on his door again, and Bosch looked over and saw the boy picking the acne on his face in the door's mirror. Wish turned once more before she was out of the room.
"I wasn't talking about my little brother," she said. "He was my big brother, actually, and I was talking about a long time ago, about the way he looked when I was a little girl and he was going away for a while, to Vietnam."
Bosch didn't look at her. He couldn't. He realized what was coming.
"I remember how he looked then," she said, "because it was the last time I saw him. It sticks with you. He was one of the ones that didn't come back."
She walked out. Harry ate the last slice of pizza. It was cold, and he hated anchovies, and he felt he deserved it that way. Same for the Coke, which was warm. Afterward, he sat at the homicide table and made calls until he found an empty bed, rather, an empty space in one of the no-questions-asked shelters near the boulevard. At Home Street Home, they didn't try to send runaways back to where they came from. They knew in most cases home was a worse nightmare than the streets. They just gave the children a safe place to sleep, and then tried to send them off to any place but Hollywood. He checked out an unmarked car and drove Sharky to his motorbike. It would not fit in the trunk, so Bosch made a deal with the boy. Sharky would ride the bike to the shelter, and Bosch would follow. When the boy got there and got checked in, Bosch would give him back his money and wallet and cigarettes, but not the Polaroids and the joint. Those went into the trash. Sharky didn't like it, but he did it. Bosch told him to hang around the shelter a couple of days, though he knew the boy would probably split first thing in the morning. "I found you once. If I need to, I can do it again," he said, as the boy locked his bike up outside the home.
I know,"
Sharky said. It was an idle threat. Bosch knew that he had found Sharky when the boy didn't know he was being looked for. It would be a different story if he wanted to hide. Bosch gave the boy one of his cheap business cards and told him to give a call if he thought of anything that would help.
"That would help you or me?"
Sharky asked. Bosch didn't answer. He got back in the car and drove back to the station on Wilcox, watching the mirror for signs of a tail. He didn't see any. After checking the car in, he went to his desk and picked up the FBI files. He went to the watch office, where the night lieutenant called one of his patrol units in to give Bosch a lift to the federal building. The patrol officer was a young cop with a quarter-inch hairdo. Asian. Bosch had heard around the station that he was called Gung Ho. They rode in silence the whole 20 minutes to the federal building. Harry got home by 9. The red light on his phone machine was blinking, but there was no message, just the sound of someone hanging up. He turned on the radio for the Dodgers game, but then he turned it off, tired of hearing people talk. He put CDs by Sonny Rollins, Frank Morgan, and Branford Marsalis into the stereo and listened to the saxophone instead. He spread the files out on the table in the dining room and turned the cap on a bottle of beer. Alcohol and jazz, he thought as he swallowed. Sleeping with your clothes on. You're a cliché cop, Bosch. An open book. And no different from the dozen other fools who must hit on her every day. Just stick to the business in front of you and don't hope for anything else. He opened the file on Meadows, carefully reading every page, whereas before, in the car with Wish, he had only skimmed. Meadows was an enigma to Bosch. A pillhead, a heroin user, but a soldier who had re-upped to stay in Vietnam. Even after they took him out of the tunnels, he stayed. In 1970, after 2 years in the tunnels, he was assigned to a military police unit attached to the American Embassy in Saigon. Never saw enemy action again, but stayed right up to the end. After the treaty and pullout of 1973, he got a discharge and stayed on again, this time as one of the civilian advisors attached to the embassy. Everybody was going home, but not Meadows. He didn't leave until April 30th, 1975, the day of the fall of Saigon. He was on a helicopter and then a plane ferrying refugees out of the country on their way to the United States. That was his last government assignment, security on the massive refugee transport to the Philippines and then to the States. According to the records, Meadows stayed in Southern California after coming back, but his skills were limited to military police, tunnel killer, and drug dealer. There was an LAPD application in the file that was marked rejected. He failed the drug test. Next in the file was a National Criminal Intelligence computer sheet that showed Meadows' record. His first arrest for possession of heroin was in 1978, probation. The next year he was popped again, this time for possession with intent to sell. He pleaded it out to simple possession and got 18 months at Wayside Honor Rancho. He did 10 of them. The next 2 years were marked by frequent arrests on Mark's beefs, fresh needle tracks being a misdemeanor good for 60 days in county lockup. It looked like Meadows was riding the revolving door at county until 1981, when he went away for some substantial time. It was for attempted robbery, a federal beef. The NCIC printout didn't say if it was bank robbery, but Bosch figured it had to be to bring the feds in. The sheet said Meadows was sentenced to 4 years at Lompoc and served 2. He wasn't out but a few months before he was picked up for a bank robbery. They must have had him cold. He pleaded guilty and took 5 years back to Lompoc. He would have been out in 3, but 2 years into the sentence he was busted in an escape attempt. He got 5 more years and was transferred to Terminal Island. Meadows was paroled from TI in 1988. All those years in stir, Bosch thought. He never knew, never heard from him. What would he have done if he had heard? He thought about that for a moment. It probably changed Meadows more than the war. He was paroled to a halfway house for Vietnam vets. The place was called Charlie Company and was on a farm north of Ventura, about 40 miles from Los Angeles. He stayed there nearly a year. After that, there were no further contacts, according to Meadows' sheet. The Mark's beef that had prompted Meadows to call Bosch a year earlier had never been processed. It wasn't on the sheet. No other known contact with police upon his release from prison. There was another sheet in the package. This one was handwritten, and Bosch guessed it was Wish's clean, legible hand. It was a work and home history, gathered from record searches of Social Security and DMV records. The entries ran vertically down the left side of the paper. But there were gaps, time periods unaccounted for. Meadows had worked for the Southern California Water District when he first came back from Vietnam. He was a pipeline inspector. He lost the job after 4 months for excessive tardiness and sick outs. From there, he must have tried his hand at dealing heroin, because the next lawful employment was not listed until after he got out of Wayside in 1979. He went to work for DWP as an underground inspector, storm drainage division. Lost the job 6 months later for the same reasons as with the water district. There were a few other sporadic employments. After he left Charlie Company, he caught on with a gold mining company in the Santa Clarita Valley for a few months. Nothing else. There were almost a dozen home addresses listed. Most of them were apartments in Hollywood. There was a house in San Pedro prior to the 1979 bust. If he was dealing at the time, he was probably getting it at the port in Long Beach, Bosch thought. The San Pedro address would have been convenient. Bosch also saw that he had lived in the Sepulveda apartment since leaving Charlie Company. There was nothing else in the file about the halfway house or what Meadows did there. Bosch found the name of Meadows' parole officer on the copies of his 6-month evaluation reports. Darryl Slater worked out of Van Nuys. Bosch wrote it down in the notebook. He also wrote down the address of Charlie Company. He then spread the arrest sheet, the work and home history, and the parole reports out in front of him. On a new piece of paper, he began to write out a chronology, beginning with Meadows' being sent to federal prison in 1981. When he was done, many of the gaps were closed. Meadows served a total of 6.5 years in the federal pen. He was paroled in early 1988 when he was sponsored by the Charlie Company program. He spent 10 months in the program before moving to the apartment in Sepulveda. Parole reports showed he secured a job as a drill operator in the gold mine in the Santa Clarita Valley. He completed parole in February 1989, and he quit his job a day after his PO signed him off. No known employment since, according to the Social Security Administration. IRS said Meadows hadn't filed a return since 1988. Bosch went into the kitchen and got a beer out and made a ham and cheese sandwich. He stood by the sink eating and drinking, and trying to organize things about the case in his head. He believed that Meadows had been scheming from the time he walked out of TI, or at least Charlie Company. He'd had a plan. He worked legitimate jobs until he cleared parole, and then he quit, and the plan was set into action. Bosch felt sure of it, and he felt that it was therefore likely that, at either the prison or the halfway house, Meadows had hooked up with the men who had burglarized the bank with him, and then killed him. The doorbell rang. Bosch checked his watch and saw it was 11 o'clock. He walked to the door and looked through the peephole and saw Eleanor Wish staring at him. He stepped back, glanced at the mirror in the entrance hall, and saw a man with dark, tired eyes looking back at him. He smoothed his hair and opened the door.
"Hello," she said. "Truce?"
"Truce? How'd you know where I..." "Never mind. Come in." She was wearing the same suit as earlier, hadn't been home yet. He saw her notice the files and paperwork on the card table. "Working late," he said. "Just looking over some things in the file on Meadows."
"Good. I happened to be out this way, and I just came by to say that we..." "Well, it's been a rough week so far, for both of us. Maybe tomorrow we can start this partnership over?"
"Yes," he said. "And listen, I'm sorry for what I said earlier. And I'm sorry about your brother. You were trying to say something nice and... Can you stay a few minutes? Have a beer?" He went to the kitchen and got 2 fresh bottles. He handed her one and led her through the sliding door to the porch. It was cool out, but there was a warm wind occasionally blowing up the side of the dark canyon. Eleanor Wish looked out at the lights of the valley. The spotlights from Universal City swept the sky in a repetitive pattern.
"This is very nice," she said. "I've never been in one of these. They're called cantilevers?"
"Yes."
"Must be scary during an earthquake."
"It's scary when the garbage truck drives by."
"So, how'd you end up in a place like this?"
"Some people, the ones down there with the spotlights, gave me a bunch of money once to use my name and my so-called technical advice for a TV show. So I didn't have anything else to do with it. When I was growing up in the valley, I always wondered what it would be like to live in one of these things. So I bought it. It used to belong to a movie writer. This is where he worked. It's pretty small, only one bedroom. But that's all I'll ever need, I guess. She leaned on the railing and looked down the slope into the arroyo. In the dark, there was only the dim outline of the live oak grove below. He also leaned over and absentmindedly peeled bits of the gold foil label off his beer bottle and dropped them. The gold glinted in the darkness as it fluttered down out of sight. "I have questions," he said. "I want to go up to Ventura."
"Can we talk about it tomorrow? I didn't come up to go over the files. I've been reading those files for almost a year now."
He nodded and stayed quiet, deciding to let her get to whatever it was that brought her. After some time, she said,
"You must be very angry about what we did to you. The investigation, us checking you out, then what happened yesterday. I'm sorry."
She took a small sip from her bottle, and Bosch realized he had never asked if she wanted a glass. He let her words hang out there in the dark for a few long moments. "No," he finally said. "I'm not angry. The truth is, I don't really know what I am." She turned and looked at him.
"We thought you'd drop it when Rourke made trouble for you with your lieutenant. Sure, you knew Meadows, but that was a long time ago. That's what I don't get. It's not just another case for you. But why? There must be something more. Back in Vietnam? Why does it mean so much to you?"
"I guess I have reasons. Reasons that have nothing to do with the case."
"I believe you. But whether I believe you is not the point. I'm trying to know what's going on. I need to know."
"How's your beer?"
"It's fine. Tell me something, Detective Bosch."
He looked down and watched a little piece of the printed foil disappear in the black.
"I don't know," he said.
"Actually, I do know, and I don't. I guess it goes back to the tunnels. Shared experience. It's nothing like he saved my life or I saved his. Not that easy. But I feel something is owed. No matter what he did or what kind of fuck-up he became after. Maybe if I had done more than make a few calls for him last year, I don't know."
"Don't be silly," she said. "When he called you last year, he was well into this caper. He was using you then. It's like he's using you now, even though he's dead."
He'd run out of label to peel. He turned around and leaned his back on the railing. He fumbled a cigarette out of his pocket with one hand, put it in his mouth, but didn't light it. "Meadows," he said, and shook his head at the memory of the man. "Meadows was something else. Back then, we were all just a bunch of kids, afraid of the dark. And those tunnels were so damn dark. But Meadows, he wasn't afraid. He'd volunteer and volunteer and volunteer, out of the blue and into the black. That's what he said going on a tunnel mission was. We called it the Black Echo. It was like going to hell. You're down there and you could smell your own fear. It was like you were dead when you were down there." They had gradually turned so that they were facing each other. He searched her face and saw what he thought was sympathy. He didn't know if that's what he wanted. He was long past that. But he didn't know what he wanted. "So all of us scared little kids, we made a promise. Every time anybody went down into one of the tunnels, we made a promise. The promise was that no matter what happened down there, nobody would be left behind. Didn't matter if you died down there, you wouldn't be left behind. Because they did things to you, you know, like our own psychops. And it worked. Nobody wanted to be left behind, dead or alive. I read once in a book that it doesn't matter if you're lying beneath a marble tombstone on a hill or at the bottom of an oil sump. When you're dead, you're dead. But whoever wrote that wasn't over there. When you're alive, but you're that close to dying, you think about those things. And then it does matter. And so, we made the promise." Bosch knew he hadn't explained a thing. He told her he was going to get another beer. She said she was fine. When he came back out, she smiled at him and said nothing. "Let me tell you a story about Meadows," he said. "See, the way they worked it was, they'd assign a couple, maybe three of us tunnel rats, to go out with a company. So when they'd come across a tunnel, we'd zip on down, check it out, mine it, whatever." He took a long pull on the fresh beer. "So once..." Oh, this would have been back in 1970. "Meadows and me were tagging at the back of a patrol. We were in a VC stronghold. Man, it was just riddled with tunnels. Anyway, we were about 3 miles from a village called Mon Luc when we lost a point man. He got..." "I'm sorry. You probably don't want to hear this with your brother and all."
"I do want to hear. Please."
"So this point got shot by a sniper who was in a spider hole. That was what they called little entrances to a tunnel network. So somebody took out the sniper, and then me and Meadows had to go down the hole to check it out. We went down, and right away we had to split up. This was a big network. I followed one line one way, and he went the other. We had said we'd go for 15 minutes, set charges with a 20-minute delay, then head back, setting more along the way. I remember I found a hospital down there. 4 empty grass mats, a cabinet of supplies, all just sitting in the middle of this tunnel. I remember I thought, Jesus Christ, what's going to be around the bend, a drive-in movie or something? I mean, these people had dug themselves in. Anyway, there was a little altar in there, and there was incense burning, still burning. I knew then that they were still in there somewhere, the VC. It scared me. I set a charge and hid it behind the altar, and then I started back as fast as I could. I set 2 more charges along the way, timing everything so it would all go off at once. So I get back to the drop-in point, you know, the original spider hole, and no Meadows. I waited a few minutes, and it's getting close. You don't want to be down there when the C4 goes. Some of those tunnels are 100 years old. There was nothing I could do, so I climbed out. He wasn't up top either. He stopped to drink some beer and think about the story. She watched intently, but didn't prod him. A few minutes later, my charges went off in the tunnel. At least the part I had been in came down. Whoever was in there was dead and buried. We waited a couple hours for the smoke and dust to settle. We hooked a Mighty Mite fan up and blew air down the entry shaft, and then you could see smoke being pushed out and coming up out of the air vents and other spider holes all around the jungle. And when it was clear, me and another guy went in to find Meadows. We thought he was dead, but we had the promise. No matter what, we were going to get him out and send him home. But we didn't find him. Spent the rest of the day down there looking, but all we found were dead VC. Most of them had been shot, some had cut throats. All of them had ears slashed off. When we came up, the top told us we couldn't wait anymore. We had orders. We pulled out, and I had broken the promise. Bosch was staring blankly out into the night, seeing only the story he was telling. 2 days later, another company was in the village, Mon Luc, and somebody found a tunnel entrance in a hooch. They get their rats to check it out, and they aren't in that tunnel more than 5 minutes when they find Meadows. He was just sitting like Buddha in one of the passageways, out of ammo, talking gibberish, not making sense, but he was okay. And when they tried to get him to come up with them, he didn't want to. They finally had to tie him up and put a rope on him and have the patrol up there pull him out. Up in the sunlight, they saw he was wearing a necklace of human ears, strung with his tags. He finished the beer and walked in off the balcony. She followed him to the kitchen, where he got a fresh bottle. She put her half-finished bottle on the counter. "So that's my story. As Meadows. He went to Saigon for some R&R, but he came back. He couldn't stay away from the tunnels. After that one, though, he was never the same. He told me that he just got mixed up and lost down there. He just kept going in the wrong direction, killing anything he came across. The word was that there were 33 ears on his necklace. And somebody asked me once, why Meadows let one of the VC keep an ear? You know, accounting for the odd number. And I told him that Meadows let them all keep an ear. She shook her head. He nodded his. Bosch said, I wish I had found him that time I went back in to look. I let him down. They both stood for a while, looking down at the kitchen floor. Bosch poured the rest of his beer down the sink.
One question about Meadows' sheet and then no more business, he said. He got jammed up at Lompoc on an escape attempt, then sent to T.I. You know anything about that?
Yes, and it was a tunnel. He was a trustee and he worked in the laundry. The gas dryers had underground vents going out of the building. He dug beneath one of them. No more than an hour a day, they said he had probably been at it at least 6 months before it was discovered, when the sprinklers they use in the summer on the rec field softened the ground and there was a cave-in.
He nodded his head. He figured it had been a tunnel.
The two others that were in on it, she said, a drug dealer and a bank robber, they're still inside. There's no connection to this.
He nodded again.
I think I should go now, she said. We have a lot to do tomorrow.
Yeah. I have a lot more questions.
I'll try to answer them if I can.
She passed closely by him in the small space between the refrigerator and counter and moved out into the hallway. He could smell her hair as she went by. An apple scent, he thought. He noticed that she was looking at the print hanging on the wall opposite the mirror in the hallway. It was in three separate framed sections and was a print of a 15th-century painting called The Garden of Delights. The painter was a Dutchman.
Hieronymus Bosch,
she said as she studied the nightmarish landscape of the painting.
When I saw that was your full name, I wondered if...
No relation, he said. My mother, she just liked his stuff. I guess because of the last name.
She sent that print to me once, said in the note that it reminded her of L.A., old crazy people. My foster parents, they didn't like it, but I kept it for a lot of years. Had it hanging there as long as I've had this place.
But you like to be called Harry.
Yeah, I like Harry.
Good night, Harry. Thanks for the beer.
Good night, Eleanor. Thanks for the company.
Part 4. Wednesday, May 23rd. By 10 a.m., they were on the Ventura Freeway, which cuts across the bottom of the San Fernando Valley and out of the city. Bosch was driving, and they were going against the grain of traffic, heading northwest toward Ventura County, and leaving behind the blanket of smog that filled the valley like dirty cream in a bowl. They were heading to Charlie Company. The FBI had only done a cursory check on Meadows and the prison outreach program the year before. Wish said she had thought its importance was minimal because Meadows' stay had ended nearly a year before the tunnel caper. She said the Bureau had requested a copy of Meadows' file, but had not checked the names of other convicts who were part of the program at the same time as Meadows. Bosch thought this was a mistake. Meadows' work record indicated the bank caper was part of a long-range plan, he told Wish. The bank burglary might have been hatched at Charlie Company. Before leaving, Bosch had called Meadows' parole officer, Darrell Slater, and was given a rundown on Charlie Company. Slater said the place was a vegetable farm owned and operated by an army colonel who was retired and born again. He contracted with the state and federal prisons to take early release cases, the only requirement being that they be Vietnam combat veterans. That wasn't too difficult a bill to fill, Slater said. As in every other state in the country, the prisons in California had high populations of Vietnam vets. Gordon Scales, the former colonel, didn't care what crimes the vets had been convicted of, Slater said. He just wanted to set them right again. The place had a staff of three, including Scales, and held no more than 24 men at a time. The average stay was 9 months. They worked the vegetable fields from 6 to 3, stopping only for lunch at noon. After the workday, there was an hour-long session called Soul Talk, then dinner and TV, another hour of religion before lights out. Slater said Scales used his connections in the community to place the vets in jobs when they were ready for the outside world. In 6 years, Charlie Company had a recidivist record of only 11%, a figure so enviable that Scales got a favorable mention in a speech by the president during his last campaign swing through the state. Slater said,
The man's a hero, and not 'cause of that war, for what he did after.
When you get a place like that, moving maybe 30-40 cons through the year, and only 1 in 10 gets his ass in a jam again, then you are talking about a major success. Scales, he has the ear of the federal and state parole boards and half the wardens in this state.
Does that mean he gets to pick who goes to Charlie Company? Bosch asked.
Maybe not pick, but give final approval to, yes. But the word on this guy is out. His name is known in every and any cell block where you got a vet doing time. These guys come to him. They send letters, send Bibles, make phone calls, have lawyers get in contact, all to get Scales to sponsor them.
Is that how Meadows got there?
Far as I know, he was already heading there when he was assigned to me. You'd have to call Terminal Island and have them check their files or talk to Scales.
Bosch filled Wish in on the conversation while they were on the road. Otherwise, it was a long ride, and there were long periods of silence. Bosch spent much of the time wondering about the night before, her visit. Why had she come? After they crossed into Ventura County, his mind came back to the case, and he asked her some of the questions he had come up with the night before while reviewing the files. Why didn't they hit the main vault? At Westland, there were two vaults, safe deposit and then the bank's main vault for the cash and the teller's boxes. The crime scene reports said the design of both vaults was the same. The safe deposit vault was bigger, but the armoring on the floor was the same. So it would seem that Meadows and his partners could just as easily have tunneled to the main vault, gotten in, and taken whatever was there and gotten out. No need to risk spending a whole weekend inside. No need to pry open safe deposit boxes either.
Maybe they didn't know they were the same. Maybe they assumed the main vault would be tougher.
But we are assuming they had some knowledge of the safe deposit vault's structure before they started on this. Why didn't they have the same knowledge of the other vault?
They couldn't recon the main vault. It's not open to the public. But we think one of them rented a box in the safe deposit vault and went in to check it out. Used the phony name, of course. But see, they could check out one vault and not the other. Maybe that's why.
Bosch nodded and said, "How much was in the main vault?"
"Don't know offhand. It should have been in the reports I gave you. If not, it's in the other files back at the bureau."
More, though, right? There was more cash in the main vault than what, the $2 or $3 million in property they got from the boxes?
I think that is probably right. See what I'm saying?
If they had hit the main vault, the stuff would have been laying around in sacks and bags, right there for the taking. It would have been easier. There probably would have been more money for less trouble.
But, Harry, we know that from hindsight. Who knows what they knew going in? Maybe they thought there was more in the boxes. They gambled and lost.
But maybe they won. She looked over at him. Maybe there was something there in the boxes that we don't even know about, that nobody reported missing. Something that made the safe deposit vault the better target, made it worth more than the main vault.
If you're thinking drugs, the answer is no. We thought of that. We had the DEA bring around one of their dogs, and he went through the broken boxes. Nothing. No trace of drugs. He then sniffed around the boxes the thieves hadn't gotten to, and he got one hit on one of the small ones.
She laughed for a moment and said,
"So then we drilled this box the dog went nuts over and found 5 grams of coke in a bag. This poor guy who kept his coke stash at the bank got busted just because somebody happened to tunnel into the same vault."
Wish laughed again, but it seemed to be a little forced to Bosch. The story wasn't that funny.
"Anyway," she said, "the case against the guy was kicked by an assistant U.S. attorney because he said it was a bad search. We violated the guy when we drilled his box without a warrant."
Bosch exited the freeway into the town of Ventura and headed north. "I still like the drug angle, despite the dog," he said after a quarter hour of silence. "They aren't infallible, those dogs. If the stuff was packed in there right and the thieves got it, there may not have been a trace. A couple of those boxes with coke in them, and the caper starts being worth their while."
"Your next question will be about the customer lists, right?" she said.
"Right."
"Well, we did a lot of work on that. We checked everybody, right down to tracing purchases of things they said were in the boxes. We didn't find who did the job, but we probably saved the bank's insurance companies a couple million in paying for things that were reported stolen but never really existed."
He pulled into a gas station so he could take out a map book from under the seat and figure out the way to Charlie Company. She continued to defend the FBI investigation.
"The DEA looked at every name on the box holder list and drew a blank. We ran the names through NCIC. We got a few hits, but nothing serious, mostly old stuff.
She gave another one of those short, fake laughs.
One of the holders of one of the bigger boxes had a kiddie porn conviction from the 70s. Served a deuce at Soledad. Anyway, after the bank job, he was contacted and he reported nothing was taken. Said he had recently emptied his box. But they say these pedophiles can never part with their stuff, their photos and films, even letters written about kids. And there was no record at the bank of him going into the box in the 2 months before the burglary, so we figured that the box was for his collection. But anyway, that had nothing to do with the job. Nothing we turned up did.
Bosch found the way on the map and pulled out of the service station. Charlie Company was in Grove Country. He thought about her story about the pedophile. Something about it bothered him. He rolled it around in his head but couldn't get to it. He let it drift and went on to another question. Why was nothing ever recovered? All that jewelry and bonds and stocks, and nothing ever turns up except for a single bracelet. Not even any of the other worthless things that were taken.
They're sitting on it until they think they're clear,
Wish said.
That's why Meadows was smoked. He went out of line and pawned the bracelet before he should have. Maybe before everyone agreed they were clear. They found out he'd sold it. He wouldn't say where, so they buzzed him until he told them. Then they killed him.
And by coincidence, I get the call.
It happens.
There's something in that story that doesn't work, Bosch said. We start out with Meadows getting juiced. Tortured, right? He tells them what they want. They put the hot load in his arm, and they go get the bracelet from the pawn shop, okay?
Okay.
But see, it doesn't work. I've got the pawn slip. It was hidden. So he didn't give it to them, and they had to go break in the shop and take the bracelet, covering the scam by also taking a lot of other junk. So if he didn't give them the pawn slip, how'd they know where the bracelet was?
He told them, I guess,
Wish said.
I don't think so.
I don't see him giving up one and not the other. He had nothing to gain from holding back the slip. If they got the name of the shop out of him, they would have gotten a slip.
So you're saying he died before he told them anything? And they already knew where the bracelet was pawned.
Right. They worked him to get the ticket, but he wouldn't give it up, wouldn't break. They killed him. Then they dumped the body and rolled his place. But they still don't find the pawn stub, so they hit the pawn shop like third-rate burglars. The question is, if Meadows didn't tell them where he had sold the bracelet, and they didn't find the stub, how did they know where it was?
Harry, this is speculation on top of speculation.
That's what cops do.
Well, I don't know. Could have been a lot of things. They could have had a tail on Meadows because they didn't trust him and could have seen him go into the pawn shop. Could have been a lot of things.
Could have been they had somebody, say a cop, who saw the bracelet on the monthly pawn sheets and told them. The sheets go to every police department in the county.
I think that kind of speculation is reckless.
They were there. Bosch braked the car at a gravel entranceway below a wooden sign with a green eagle painted on it and the words Charlie Company. The gate was open, and they drove down a gravel road with muddy irrigation ditches running along both sides. The road split the farmland, with tomatoes on the right and what smelled like peppers on the left. Up ahead there was a large, aluminum-sided barn and a sprawling ranch-style house. Behind these, Bosch could see a grove of avocado trees. They drove into a circular parking area in front of the ranch house, and Bosch cut the engine. A man wearing a white apron that was as clean as his shaven head came to the screen at the front door.
"Mr. Scales here?" Bosch asked.
"Colonel Scales, you mean? No, he is not. It's almost time for chow, though. He'll be coming in from the field then."
The man did not invite them to come in out of the sun, and so Bosch and Wish went back and sat in the car. A few minutes later, a dusty white pickup truck drove up. It had an eagle inside a large letter C painted on the driver's door. Three men got out of the cab, and six more piled out of the back. They moved quickly toward the ranch house. They ranged in age from late 30s to late 40s. They wore military green pants and white T-shirts soaked with sweat. No one wore a bandana or sunglasses or had his sleeves rolled up. No one's hair was longer than a quarter inch. The white men were burned brown like stained wood. The driver, wearing the same uniform but at least 10 years older than the rest, slowed to a stop and let the others go inside. As he approached, Bosch put him on the early side of his 60s,
but a guy who was almost as solid as he had been in his 20s. His hair, what could be seen of it against his gleaming skull, was white, and his skin was like walnut. He was wearing work gloves.
"Help you?"
he asked.
"Colonel Scales?" Bosch said. "That's right, you police."
Bosch nodded and made introductions. Scales didn't seem too impressed, even with the FBI being mentioned.
"You remember about 7, 8 months ago the FBI asked you for some information on a William Meadows who spent some time here?" Wish asked.
"Sure I do. I remember every time you people call up or come around asking about one of my boys. I resent it, so I remember it. You want more information on Billy? Is he in some trouble?"
"Not anymore," Bosch said.
"What's that supposed to mean?" Scales said. "Sounds like you're saying he's dead."
"You didn't know?" Bosch said.
"Course I didn't. Tell me what happened to him."
Bosch thought he saw genuine surprise and then a flashing hint of sadness cross Scales' face. The news had hurt. "He was found dead 3 days ago in L.A. A homicide. We think it is related to a crime he took part in last year that you may have heard about from the FBI's previous contact."
"The tunnel thing at that bank in L.A.?" he asked. "I know what I was told by the FBI, that's it."
"That's fine," Wish said. "What we need from you is more complete information about who was here when Meadows was. We went over this ground before, but we're rechecking, looking for anything that might help. Will you cooperate with us?"
"I always cooperate with you people. I don't like it because half the time I think you got your wires crossed. Most of my boys, when they leave here, they don't get mixed up again. We have a good record here. If Meadows did what you're saying he did, he is the rarity."
"We understand that," she said, "and this will be strictly confidential."
"All right, then, come into my office and you can ask your questions."
As they went through the front door, Bosch saw two long tables in what was probably once the ranch house's living room. About 20 men sat before plates of what looked like chicken-fried steaks and mounds of vegetables. Not one looked at Eleanor Wish. That was because they were silently saying grace, their heads down, eyes closed, and hands folded. Bosch could see tattoos on almost every arm. When they stopped their prayer, a chorus of forks struck home on the plates. A few of the men took the time then to look at Eleanor approvingly. The man in the apron who had come to the screen door earlier now stood in the doorway of the kitchen.
"Colonel, are you in with the men today, sir?"
he called. Scales nodded and said,
"Yeah, I'll be through in a few minutes."
They went down a hallway and through the first door into an office that was supposed to be a bedroom. It was crowded by a desk with a top the size of a door. Scales pointed to two chairs in front of it, and Bosch and Wish sat down while he took the upholster job behind the desk.
"Now, I know exactly what I am required by law to give you and what I don't have to even speak to you about. But I am inclined to do more if it will help and we have an understanding. Meadows, I sort of knew he would end up as you say he did. I prayed to the good Lord to guide him, but I knew. I will help you. No one should take a life in a civilized world, no one at all."
"Colonel," Bosch began, "we appreciate your help. I want you to know, first off, that we know what kind of job you're doing here. We know you have the respect and encouragement of both state and federal authorities. But our investigation of Meadows' death leads us to conclude he was involved in a conspiracy with other men who had the same skills as he, and..."
"You're saying they are vets,"
Scales cut in. He was filling a pipe with tobacco from a canister on the desk.
"Possibly. We have not identified them yet, so we don't know it for a fact. But if that is the case, there would seem a possibility that the players in the conspiracy may have met here. I stress the word may. Therefore, there are two things we want from you. A look at any records you still have on Meadows, and a list of every man that was here during the 10 months he was."
Scales was tamping his pipe and seemingly paying no attention to what had just been said. Then he said,
"No problem on his records. He's dead. On the other, I suppose I should call my lawyer just to make sure I can do that. We run a good program here, and vegetables and money from the state and the feds don't cover it. I get out the soapbox and make the rounds. We rely on the tithings of the community, civic organizations, things like that. Bad publicity will dry that money up faster than a Santa Ana wind. I help you, I risk that. The other risk is the loss in the faith of the men who come here for a new start. See, most of those men that were here back when Meadows was, they've gone on to new lives. They aren't criminals anymore. If I'm handing out their names to every cop that comes around, then that doesn't look too good for my program, does it?
Colonel Scales, we don't have time for lawyers to look